Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us today is our roundtable to discuss the week in Washington and beyond. Joining us are Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners, Michael Herson of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense and aerospace lobbying firms, and former Pentagon comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who among his many roles serves as a senior advisor to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Everybody, thanks very much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Vago.
Great to be back, Vago.
Good to be here, Vago.
Great to have all of you guys back on. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense sponsors our technology coverage. And Rafael Advanced Defense Systems sponsors our air and missile defense coverage. As it would so happen on the 10th anniversary of the Iron Dome system that has been making headlines around the world, indeed, a commitment from the President of the United States to replenish Israel's stocks of Iron Dome interceptors. Obviously, the program developed collaboratively between the United States and Israel. Michael, you start us off as you do every week. Republican lawmakers whose lives were threatened on January 6th, some of whom spent many years studying and driving an investigation of the Benghazi attack, have concluded that America's first ever insurrection was unworthy of deeper scrutiny, blocking a bipartisan special investigation of the incident. Many believe that one of the reasons for that is that it would incriminate some senior GOP members. This happened as Democrats have advanced a new spending measure, security spending measure, to better safeguard the Capitol from future assaults. And obviously, the administration worked behind the scenes closely with Egypt and other allies and partners to broker a ceasefire in the latest Israel-Hamas conflict. Michael, start us off, right? Weird week on the Hill. Aside from blocking the January 6th investigation, GOP lawmakers in the Senate voted and failed to pass a measure for defense spending parity, right? That for each dollar that goes to defense, or I should say non-defense spending, the same amount of money should be spent on defense. And then the budget is coming out on the 28th. The Office of Management Budget has confirmed that. Start us off. Where are we on the budget that, you know, chairmen have been clamoring for? We're having hearings, but there's no budget. And we've also got a markup. There's no budget. Kind of walk us through the insanity that's going on up there.
Okay, I'll do my best. So,
listen, first, I know you've been stealing for this all week long, right? So
exactly. And it literally changes by the day, especially right. The date of when we expect to have the budget come out. You know, we were expecting May 27th yesterday. OMB said it'd be May 28th. Let's see what they say next week. But I think there's a sense that will be the date they stick to. But as a result, that has shifted markup dates for the authorizers. The Senate still, I think, plans to mark up later in July, around July 21st, but we won't see floor action on their bill until September. But for the first time ever, the House Armed Services Committee will not mark up their bill until September. Adam Smith plans to mark up his bill on September 1st and then hope to have floor action sometime shortly thereafter. And they're only in session for 2 weeks in September. So the time between September and the end of the year are going to be very difficult for not only NDAA, but also finishing up all the appropriations bills. As you mentioned, too, as far as the budget goes, there was an amendment voted on in the Senate yesterday to create parity between defense spending and non-defense domestic discretionary spending. And that amendment was defeated on a party line basis. But it's important to note that this parity is something that the Democrats would argue for during the Budget Control Act era, when there would strike a budget deal every 2 years to raise defense spending. Democrats would insist on parity for non-defense domestic discretionary spending. And that was usually the case, that they would agree to that. But now that the shoe's on the other foot, defense is not going to be getting the same treatment, and non-defense domestic discretionary will go up when adjusted for inflation, when defense and homeland security spending will not. Now, there will be a fight over the top line. It's a question of how serious the fight's going to be. I've talked to several members of Congress this week on the Republican side who feel that have said that Inhofe and Reid will agree to raise the top line. We'll see. I know that on the House side, they're going to press for a 3% increase. Here on the Senate side, they're pressing for a 5% increase. But in the end, I think that's really going to be dictated by the appropriators. If the authorizers are going so late, the appropriators are going first, and they're going to mark up their bills in June, have floor auction in July. So I think the fight on the top line will really be more on the appropriation side and not on, on the authorization side.
Any hint from appropriators whether they're going to go along with that, whether DeLauro in the House or on the Senate side?
No hint at all. But I do think that there is a stark realization that they cannot pass these bills without Republican support. Now, they could try and combine the defense bill with the Labor H bill to lure enough Democratic support. But with the slim majority they have, I think that would be very difficult. So this really remains to be seen. There are no allocations yet for the committees, so we still have a ways to go. And you know, we saw this yesterday, you know, when the House voted on the security supplemental package, the $1.9 billion, you know, which was money for, you know, the security upgrades of the Capitol, repair of the facilities that were damaged in the attack, reimbursement for costs of responding to the attack. But the controversial provision, or one of them really, was this quick reaction force, you know, a National Guard quick reaction force that would cost $200 million. Ranking Member Mike Rogers came out against it. Senator Inhofe has also come out against it, the Senate side, although the Senate hasn't voted on this yet. And they really, you know, think that the Capitol complex security should remain a federal civilian law enforcement responsibility. And Mike Rogers, you know, pointed out that Lieutenant General Honoré's task force recommended that lawmakers create a federal civilian task force. And this is really not within the Guard's jurisdiction. It's time for them to go back to their core functions. And there are posse comitatus, you know, issues, you know, related to that. Right. But this bill only passed by one vote. It passed 213 to 212 because Pelosi started to have trouble with the progressives on her left. They came out complaining about the bill because they felt it didn't address accountability for some of the Capitol Police officers they felt were complicit. So they were scrambling in an absolute panic at the end, and they got members of the so-called squad and other progressives just to vote present instead of voting no, and had this bill just squeak by. And as you know, the day before, they voted on a related measure, which was the commission, this January 6th commission to take a look and investigate what happened. And, you know, there was some argument, too, that really should have had the commission first to make the recommendations before passing all the things that were in the security supplemental. But even that, this negotiation on the January 6th commission has been going on for a long time. And there have been a lot of concessions made in order to make this happen. I mean, initially, Pelosi wanted the Democrats to have more commissioners than Republicans. Republicans weren't going to go to that, so she conceded. She wanted the Democrats really to have the subpoena power. She conceded on that. The next issue was the jurisdiction. And, you know, John Katko was tasked with making this work and really kind of worked out some of the jurisdictional issues that they would have some freedom, flexibility to look at some other political violence beyond the January 6th attack. And at the end, the rug was pulled out from under him. You know, McCarthy really felt that, you know, Pelosi is just going to extend this commission into 22 as a way to tie Trump to the January 6th insurrection and hurt vulnerable Republicans. But 35 Republicans did break with them. So the measure did pass, but it still has an uncertain future in the Senate. McConnell's opposed to it. Will they filibuster it? It's a bad look for them, especially in light of anonymous letters that came from Capitol Police officers to Democrats calling out Republicans, you know, for opposing this commission. So
it went to all members, right? It wasn't just to Democrats, right? I mean, I believe they went to all members, didn't they?
I'm not sure. I mean, a specific Democratic member, I won't say, shared the letter publicly. So I don't know how many people got a copy of the letter.
Well, I just have to say, I mean, the parallels, this commission and what Katko did, right? I mean, we ended up with something that looks almost exactly like the 9/11 commission. And that was playing out in the middle of a presidential election, if I recall, in 2004, right? I mean, so, you know, the notion that something can be used as a political weapon is nothing new in Washington at the end of the day. But the sense of that rug being pulled out is you know, I mean, I spoke to a prominent Democrat this week about it. And they said, look, I mean, even for those of us who, you know, there are no independents anymore, is what he was saying. And these sort of incidents just convince us there's no such thing as coming to the middle with these guys. They're just playing us and we're not going to get played. I mean, is that the sense that you're getting from the majority side that, you know, Republicans are not particularly interested? You know what I mean? On infrastructure, for example, the proposal for infrastructure is more reminiscent to what Dove was seeing in the Bush administration than it is, you know, something that is happening in 2021.
Right. And before I mention talk about infrastructure, let me just, you know, pick up on a thread you just pulled on, which I think is really important. I think you're exactly right. I think that we will probably see Democrats create their own select committee, like the Republicans did for Benghazi, to look at this. All right. So I don't think we've heard the last of investigating January 6th, even though there are other panels investigating it right now. I wouldn't be surprised to see the Democrats go ahead and do that. But it would not have the same authority and same power as this commission would have. And you're right. I mean, we're seeing on infrastructure, you know, look, I've been saying this for weeks. I think a lot of this talk of a bipartisan infrastructure bill is really a theater. I do believe that there are a lot of Democrats and other Republicans that want a bipartisan package and that they are sincere about the work that they're doing. But I just think that the mountain is too tall to climb. I mean, there was a lot of optimism early on, but now I hear from the Senate Republican leadership that they're very skeptical that a deal can come together. You know, they're still trying to determine what infrastructure means. Is it roads, bridges, tunnels, airports, or does it include things, you know, like childcare? Republicans remain very opposed to Biden's pay fors, meaning reopening, you know, the 2017 tax bill, raising taxes on corporations and on wealthy Americans. There is some give and take on some of the user fees as pay fors, but again, we have some Democrats out there that are saying that whatever infrastructure package passes, it must have climate provisions in it. Elizabeth Warren came out the other day and laid down the gauntlet saying that she wants to make very clear that when infrastructure train moves forward, a childcare will not be left at the station once again.
Right.
So I just think these things make it insurmountable for them to come together, and eventually they're going to try and do something through reconciliation. But if we saw with this vote yesterday, how difficult it was to pass this security measure, which I think is far less controversial, I think that even passing through reconciliation will be difficult, not just in the Senate, but even more difficult in the House.
Well, look, I mean, when you have collective amnesia about what happened on January 6th, you just can't vote for a measure that says let's increase security, right? I mean, these guys were tourists within the velvet ropes, right? Not people who are breaking into the Capitol and smearing feces on the walls, including historic artworks. Very, very quickly, because I want to get to everybody else. We've got a tight show this week. Talk to us about potential House Armed Services Committee changes in the wake of the political assassination of Liz Cheney.
Well, we talked about this a little last week, and
Mike Gallagher, right? Congratulations.
Yes, exactly. Mike. Exactly. Right. So I said that Mike Gallagher would move up to the Personnel Subcommittee, and that's exactly what happened. Jim Banks has moved over to the cyber subcommittee, but musical chairs might be coming once again, because as you know, Lee Stefanik had to give up her ranking membership because she holds a Republican leadership post. But the rule also is if you announce that you are running for another office, you have to give up your ranking membership. And it is widely anticipated that Congresswoman Vicky Hartzler, who is the ranking member on the Tactical Air and Land Forces subcommittee, will announce very soon that she's running for Senate in Missouri. And that will institute another set of musical chairs. So Mike Gallagher might have the shortest tenure ever as the ranking member of the Personnel Subcommittee. and I would anticipate that the next ranking member on personnel would be Congressman Don Bacon from Nebraska, who is a retired Air Force general and very well suited for the position.
We're sure that Mike will make a great mark, even in his temporary time in that. Dove, you've been very patient. Give us your sense on where we are in some of these issues, right? I mean, you are the conservative Republican on this panel, one of a increasingly endangered breed in Washington. And how you perceive all of this, right? I mean, what are your expectations for the budget and how that plays out? But also how this is going to look for Republicans going ahead, because on any other normal year, it would look like Republicans would clean up in 22, especially with the margin this time.
Well, with respect to the budget, it is kind of weird to have hearings about a budget that isn't there. The big problem is that it looks like we're heading into continuing resolution territory. I have a piece that appeared with Mackenzie Eaglin, who's normally on this program as well, talking about perhaps releasing much more quickly the passback of OMB, which would allow members to have a better understanding of the to and fro inside the executive branch and maybe be able to move more quickly and avoid some of these CRs. This year, it doesn't really matter. They are so late. And that's a real problem. We're trying to catch up and in fact, pull ahead of the Chinese in a whole bunch of areas, but CRs don't permit new starts without explicit exceptions. They don't permit ramping up programs. CRs are just a disaster. And of course, for industry, it makes it really virtually impossible to plan any kind of long-term program. So that's a major budgetary issue that I just hope this year is an exception and that people come to their senses about all of this, because this is simply not a way of improving our posture vis-a-vis the Chinese in particular. The issue of the 22 election, I would simply say this. I think it has a lot more to do with Letitia James up in New York than anybody else. If she succeeds, as she desperately wants to get an indictment of Mr. Trump, that is going to set the Republican Party on its head. And then we just don't know how things will play out. Right now, the numbers obviously look very good. You've got a situation where the squad is helping the Republicans by driving Nancy Pelosi crazy. We will see what kind of legislation comes out, because it's not merely the Republicans, but the progressives that seem to care more about ideology than making any kind of progress. And that helps the Republicans. But I honestly believe that what happens to Mr. Trump over the next 18 months is really going to affect Republican prospects.
And I should point out for the audience that the piece you wrote with McKenzie showed up in War on the Rocks. And you've got another piece on the proposal to actually double the DARPA budget that we saw. And that's appeared in the Hill today. Talk to us a little bit about the dynamic, though, Dov, because from a political standpoint, even if Trump is out of the picture, hasn't the party fundamentally changed? And isn't what Liz Cheney is trying to do, or Adam Kinzinger, right, the two most prominent, but I mean, there are other members who are sort of trying to do their thing, whereas others have totally accepted it, right? I mean, Kevin McCarthy is not going to move any more than McConnell's going to move, any more than Jim Banks is going to move. I would say Jim is really the future of the party in many respects.
Well, I don't entirely agree. I mean, after all, Jim Banks and Seth Moulton issued a really good bipartisan report some months ago about where defense should be going. It's not at all clear to me that either McCarthy and certainly McConnell would necessarily feel bound to Trumpian ideology if Trump is not there to blackmail them. And that, we've heard over and over again how many Republican members in both houses of Congress privately say that this is driving them nuts. They, as long as the primaries basically dominated by Trump, they're going to go that route. If Trump, for whatever reason, no longer has the power that he has at this moment, that really could change things. And I think you'll see Liz Cheney coming back and Kinzinger having a lot more influence than he's got right now.
Byron, what's your sense on where we are budgetarily, where we're going to end up, and what you're already paying attention to? You've written a thoughtful budget note. You also wrote, I should flag for our audience, a fascinating piece on, right, change depends on the customer, right, wanting change. So it's one thing if you're a General Motors or any other innovative contractor, full disclosure, they are one of our sponsors, but the company drew kudos for the way that it pursued the infantry squad vehicle and set up a manufacturing facility that'll do low rate production with 20 people in Charlotte, North Carolina. But that only depends on whether or not the customer wants that kind of change. Talk to us a little bit about the budget dynamic and the piece you wrote and your logic at a time when everybody is clamoring for greater agility and change.
Let me pick up on a couple of themes, because I think Michael's spot on the whole infrastructure, kabuki that's going on in Washington right now. The ranking member on the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee released a kind of a blueprint for what they'd like to see in the FY22 budget. It was very narrowly focused on roads, bridges, and highways. And oddly, it kind of spools up with what Democrats have been talking about, but of course left out rail, froze mass transit funding, and didn't say anything about any of the other initiatives that were in the Biden American Jobs Plan. I agree with Dov, I think CR is almost baked into this year. I'm not too concerned about it. However, you know, if you can kind of get this all to a November, December finish line, I think, you know, the DOD and frankly, a lot of contractors have probably become very accustomed to the notion that things just don't start on October 1st. We've been running CRs habitually. And I think, unfortunately, to Dove's point, you know, it's going to happen again this year. You know, where I personally worry about it is if there's some broader standoff over the entire budget. We still have the debt ceiling to contend with. That's going to be potentially catalytic. So, you know, if this were to stretch into 2022, you start cascading in an election year, that's going to be an issue. The thing that I wrote really kind of pivoted off a Mitchell Institute report that I would recommend people read called Building an Agile Force, the Imperative for Speed and Adoption in the U.S. Aerospace Defense Industrial Base. And, you know, specifically what I thought was fascinating, Mitchell Institute did a webinar on that event that included Heather Penny. You can look her up. I don't want to go into her bio, but really fascinating background. And she's a senior fellow at the Mitchell Institute. But, you know, her quote was, "The structure and business model of today's aerospace and defense industrial base is not configured to invent, develop, and deliver the force of the future." She then went on to talk about, look, this really isn't an industry problem. You know, industry is responding to the behavior of the customer. And so if the customer chooses to develop a new fighter aircraft every 30 years, it drives them into sustaining older weapons systems as profit centers. And it was just a very interesting perspective from someone who I would say is not outside of this sector. She brings some real insider perspective to it. And I just think she's right. It's been something you've heard a lot from Marine Commandant General Berger, also spoke last week. I think one of his quotable quotes was, you know, if you're comfortable with the rate of change right now, then you are moving too slowly. Air Force Chief of Staff has picked this up too. So this is all interesting. It's rhetoric right now. You know, the bigger question is, are people really going to act on this?
I should point out, Heather is an F-16 pilot. She went to the Air Force Academy, and she was one of the F-16 pilots who responded on 9/11 and had to ponder whether or not one of the aircraft that she might have to bring down, she didn't have any weapons. So she's the one who called down and said, well, how do you expect us to do this? And they were like, stop them. And she began to think geometry, like, okay, so I hurl my airplane at another airplane, punch out. And her dad is an airline pilot and was an Air Force veteran as well. And so she had a concern about whether or not she'd be intercepting her dad. It's an incredible story. Michael, let me go back to you, right? I mean, we're hearing this message of change. Michelle Flournoy joined us this week, made the imperative case for change. The former chief of the Royal Navy, the former First Sea Lord, Admiral Sir George Zambellis, joined us, talked also about why we might not actually be fully appreciating how different warfighting is going to be in the future in an AI, quantum, big data future. What are the things that have to happen to get lawmakers aboard on this, right? We heard from Michael Baer last week that if they're not making this case right now for change, dumping the budget, right, waiting for the national security strategy is not going to do it. You talk to members all the time, right? I mean, there is a debate about what's legacy, right? There could be legacy systems that you use differently that can have impact. What's it going to take from your standpoint, you know, as somebody who's in the lobbying business, for the administration to get this right with members? Or is this not going to be possible in this kind of a politically charged environment where, let's even assume it is a perfect plan the administration hatches, that members are just going to attack it anyway because it's an election year and at the end of the day, it's about winning?
Well, look.
Too cynical? Too cynical?
A little, all right, but not too far off, right? I mean, because I think your second point is valid for a lot of reasons. So first, I don't see any of that big change happening this year. And it's predominantly because the budget's not there. So they're not having that discussion that they need to have, you know, with the budget, because all this has got to be threat-based. You know, here are the threats. Here's the budget we're putting forth to meet these threats. And here's why we need to make these changes. But it's not there. And the Hill's going to have to move very quickly after the budget comes up. So they're not going to have time to debate these very complex issues. So I just don't see major change happening this year. And then, as you just pointed out, next year, we're in an election year, which also makes it very hard to make those changes. And, you know, just traditionally, we don't make those really big muscle movements. It has to be incremental. But the administration has to invest the time to engage the leaders on the Hill, one, to explain the threat and why they're doing that meets the threat. Because right now, most of the press is coming out of the building, and I'm not saying this is accurate, right, is the focus on, you know, climate change, you know, transgender, you know, haircuts, you know, and things like that, that are not things that are really as relevant, you know, most people think, to war fighting. And then you've got to make the case to members how this is going to impact jobs, you know, and employment in their district, right? So if we're going to move beyond a certain system, this is why this is not going to impact you adversely, or why it means good things for you for the future. Kind of like, you know, things you work with base closure. When you close a base, everybody fights like tooth and nail to keep the base open. But studies have shown that those communities are actually better off down the road because they have more jobs, more and more economic activity, in many cases after the bases are gone. And then, as you point out, this whole debate on what's a legacy system. We have plenty of platforms that we've used as far back as the Cold War that are still in existence, but we've increased their survivability. We've increased their lethality. They still have a very important role to play, and there's nothing on the drawing board right now to replace them. So it's hard to make a definition as to what is and is not a legacy system.
Dove, you had to like push some controversial decisions. Actually, this is a good time to talk maybe about your DARPA paper a little bit, right? Because we talk about change. And so give us the example that, you know, so first about selling the change, what has to happen to sell change, right? And do it effectively, because you were in that business. And how much actual game-changing capability have we already developed that we might not even be touching?
Well,
or tapping.
Selling change is very, very important. And very often the sales are not made from the Pentagon. They're made from outside. Think of VSTOL aircraft, for example, which the Pentagon resisted for years. And now, of course, look, we rely on the Osprey and other things as well. I mean, the whole F-35 ability to fly short takeoffs is part of that legacy. And legacy generally, the Pentagon finds the most creative ways to demonstrate that whatever weapon system they've been using for the last 20 years is somehow going to be relevant for the next 20 years, regardless of context. In some cases, it's called flexibility. In other cases, they simply come up with new justifications. Maybe they work, maybe they don't, but that's where a lot of Pentagon creativity actually goes, to justifying what they've already got. The DARPA idea, Senator Sasse has recommended doubling DARPA's $3.5 billion budget to $7 billion for each of the next 5 years. And that makes a lot of sense, because DARPA, after all, did give us the internet. It did give us GPS, the Global Positioning System. But you've got to do something with what DARPA comes up with. And I, in my piece this morning, I point out that it's now 20 years. Ron Sega, who was the head of DDR&E at that time, comes to me when I was comptroller, and he says, you know, I've got this weapon that can blow terrorists out of cage. It's called a thermobaric weapon. I said, great. How many more years will it take you to develop? He says, no, it's there. I said, well, why isn't it out in the field? He said, because nobody's been interested. I need a little bit of money. How much do you need? Oh, a few tens of millions. I'm thinking, I've got a $450 billion budget, and this guy needs a few tens of millions to blow terrorists out of caves. So I give him the money in late October, and by March, we're blowing terrorists out of caves. That's the problem. And my recommendation is that Congress not only double the DARPA budget, but really carefully oversee how that money, how DARPA developments actually get into the service and are used. We've got all kinds of neat stuff out there, and not just in DARPA, maybe in some of the service labs as well. We just need to make sure it gets into the field. And in this case, I do worry that CRs don't help at all.
I should point out for our audience, right? I mean, some of our greatest innovations have come from DARPA. You know, I mean, I think, you know, everybody knows about the internet part of this, but I think that the NGAD, effort is actually a DARPA-led effort that, you know, I mean, you know, Will Roper certainly was in the chair and certainly helped shape it. But if you go back, right, Frank Kendall is the one who started that effort, if memory serves correctly. Byron, I mean, you've looked at the absorption of change. How do we need to think about this? Because the services occasionally, as I've said, can be very allergic even to the most, even to the best ideas.
You know, things do change. I mean, I would agree it's not going to happen in this year, not certainly not in this budget. I think it's probably more interesting to watch how some of the experiments are going on right now, particularly things like the Navy's experimentation with unmanned vessels, you know, the Army Convergence Project, the experiments on really kind of validating some of these technologies. I think, you know, but the central issue that everybody kind of keeps coming back to, you know, you mentioned some of the speakers that have been on your show, we're just the U.S. military, and I think this is true a lot of other militaries, is just out of kilter, out of step with how rapidly some of these other changes are taking place more broadly as a result of a lot of commercial technology. You know, how basic things like, you know, the way we shop or hail a taxi now have fundamentally changed. And I think the military will get there. I think, you know, maybe to the point on the Mitchell Institute study, you know, the customer really has to change their behavior, and industry will follow. This is never a, you know, big defense contractors are bad and it's all going to come from the smaller companies. It's, you know, it's going to be a mix, and some are going to get it and some aren't going to get it. And but that's kind of the system we live in and work with.
Admiral Zambellis made a point, which I thought was trenchant, right? At the end of the day, the governments are the ones who have to drive this change as opposed to be driven by the change. And again, right, Byron.
Yeah, and that's the point. I mean, the way you don't want to have to change is, you know, when you faced a defeat or a crisis or something, you know, the proverbial Sputnik moment, where you're really going to have to throw a lot of resources at a problem that you didn't know you had, and or that you've suffered a military defeat or a major military setback because someone thought this out a lot harder and more thoroughly than you did. And that's the bottom line imperative, but you know, fundamentally hope that that we are on top of this. But I think to the Mitchell point and some of the points that, you know, have been made by many others, the rate of speed is slow. It's just not moving fast enough.
The concern that I have now is we are not in phase zero, right? And we may not even be in phase one. And so, right, or may at least be in phase one and maybe even higher in cyber. And whether or not we're missing the nature of this competition, because everything is finite, right? I mean, everybody thinks, like, nuclear reactor has unlimited power. Nuclear reactor has X number of effective full power hours. It's a gas tank. It's a big gas tank, but it's a gas tank.
But it's
and
not,
secrets
it's,
are finite too, right? I mean, you steal enough of them. What do you have left?
Well, I was going to make, you know, it's not a new problem. We faced it in Iraq. You know, Dove wrote a book about it, basically. The Dove, I still need to get your signature on, but... you know, that we didn't really anticipate what would happen. And unfortunately, a lot of American lives were lost because we didn't think through, you know, could there be an insurgency? Gee, what happens if you have Humvees with canvas doors on them and all of a sudden you've got an insurgency with a lot of leftover explosives from a odious regime so it's not new, but it's absolutely a drum that needs to be pounded here. And I think pounded a lot harder than it is.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And Vago, look, here's the real problem. We are developing stuff. We're just not doing it quickly enough. And we tie ourselves up bureaucratically. Look at this whole mess with the cloud that went to court. And we still are nowhere with that. Meanwhile, the Chinese keep charging ahead. and not just the Chinese, the Russians as well. Every time Putin makes a major announcement, he's got some new weapon system that we're all of a sudden starting to worry about. You know, hypersonics was the one a couple of years ago, but they keep churning out new stuff. Their scientists are still pretty damn good, and engineers as well. And the Chinese keep forging ahead, and we are moving not at snail's pace, but simply not at the pace that they are. Now we keep saying, okay, something will be coming out. And what are we talking about? 2030, 2025, 2029. Chinese don't look that way. They're just churning stuff out. That to me is the fundamental problem.
Let's very quickly shift to Israel, Hamas. I wish we had more time for this, but we've got about 5 minutes or so left in the conversation. Dove, let me start with you. We had John Alterman of CSIS, one of your colleagues, as well as Ilan Berman, a frequent on our program. And we talked about sort of the strategic shifts that may be underway. What's your sense, right? Al-Sisi, right? I mean, this administration said we are applying human rights to it, but one of the more authoritarian leaders in the region, Mohammed Al-Sisi, was instrumental in negotiating this ceasefire. The president of the United States did buy time and took a lot of criticism from his own caucus by doing that for Netanyahu, but then said, hey, we got to wrap it up. And shortly after that, things did wrap up. But there's this sense that there is a very dramatic and dynamic shift in how prominent American political leaders are looking at Israel, which was unconditional acceptance of Israel's right for self-defense. And I think that everybody understands that the nation should defend itself against Hamas rockets. But now there's increasing focus on what is it that caused the rockets, the incidents, for example, and the policies that precipitated Palestinian rage, in the sense that Israel looks at this as, well, we're now in league with Saudi Arabia and Qatar and the Gulf, and Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Kuwait, and everybody else. So actually, we really don't have to solve the Palestinian problem anymore because nobody's calling for that. What's your sense on sort of the lasting political change? And then, Michael, I want to get your sense, because there is now a vote brought by Jewish American politician Bernie Sanders wanting to disapprove military aid, and includes a lot of other prominent Jewish American political leaders. Go ahead.
There's been a tectonic shift in the American Jewish community, and there just wasn't the degree of support for Israel that there's been in the past. And Ron Dermer, who is so closely tied to Netanyahu, the former ambassador, said, well, we don't care about American Jews because we've got the evangelicals. That is a disastrous approach, in my view. It links Israel not only to the Republican Party, but to an extreme element of the Republican Party. This has been Netanyahu's approach. He got away with it with Trump, but clearly there's pushback, not just from the AOCs of this world and the squads, but from a vast part of the American Jewish community, and politicians see that. And all of a sudden, they don't feel that they have to support everything Israel does. The question of how Israel treats the Palestinians, leave the Palestinians aside for a second. Look how Israel has mistreated its own citizens, that is to say, Arabs who are Israeli citizens. So a lot of politicians are looking at that and saying, we support Israel's right to exist. We support Israel's right to defend itself. We recognize that Hamas wants to destroy Israel, and Israel will have to fight back. But Israel can no longer assume that America will simply look aside as it violates the human rights of both its citizens and those in those territories that it's occupied.
Michael, how's this playing out on the Hill, and how will this disapproval vote manifest itself, do you think, ultimately?
First, I don't think in the end there will be a disapproval vote. So you mentioned Bernie Sanders, but a lot of the action right now is on the House side. So Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, and some other progressives are circulating a draft resolution of disapproval, to bar the sale of JDAMs to Israel, which is about a $735 million sale. Now, as you know, the sale is already in formal notification, so there's a clock that has to run that runs, and they would have to pass a joint resolution disapproval through both chambers by the end of next week, and the House is out of session now for 3 weeks. So that vote's just not going to happen. But what's, I think, the most significant about this resolution that's being circulated is that the chairwoman of the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, Betty McCollum, seemed to indicate support for this resolution, basically saying that it's tone deaf to be selling these kind of weapons to Israel at a time when they're bombing Palestinian families. So this support for these kind of measures is going well beyond the progressives.
Byron, let me wrap up with you. You spent a summer on a kibbutz. How is this different today than the dynamic then? Because then statesmen like Abba Ibn and virtually every Israeli prime minister always tried to make sure to stay on the right side of the message that Israel is always the victim, right? As opposed to perceived as an aggressor, right? Keep the world on our side.
It's in a permanent way. Fago, to me, it's kind of a cyclic phenomena, right? I mean, you saw the same reaction to a degree when Israel and Hezbollah went at it, and Israel really, you know, punished Lebanon harshly for that. And the old notion about mowing the grass, you know, is kind of a strategy that, you know, when when these entities acquire or build their military capability, use it against us, and then we just mow them back down. I mean, it's not going to go away. And in an odd way, you know, when I looked at this particular exchange with Hamas, they were demonstrating some new and different things. They have longer range rockets. They have they were using UAVs that were supplied by Iran. So it's not, I just don't think it's an acceptable strategy. It's going to pose risks the longer it goes on. And at some point, you know, someone's going to get a very lucky and frankly catastrophic shot. So, you know, and I suppose the other thing, it's just the environment that Israel has lived in. You know, there was so much focus on Iran and kind of a distant fight. It's like, wow, you know, this one, it kind of brought this all back home to their doorstep. And, you know, when I was here in a kibbutz, it was back in the days when, you know, the central threat was still Syria, Egypt, Iraq, and you know, the rest of the Arab coalitions.
Vago, let me just add other point, which is this. You know, Jared Kushner had an interesting idea, which was to improve the economy of the West Bank. Nothing much happened. So then he kind of pivoted and they pulled off these Abraham Accords. And I think a lot of the Israeli government, I'm not sure about Israelis, but the Israeli government kind of felt that's it. We've got the Palestinians boxed in and all will be well. And I think what this has just demonstrated, and it's kind of what Byron just said as well, is you can make peace with the Gulf states, but if you don't have peace right on your doorstep, you're going to have a problem for quite some time. And I that may be something that needs to be impressed upon not just Bibi Netanyahu, but an awful lot of the Israeli public that seems to have become almost indifferent to what's going on next door.
I should say that you for a long time actually have disputed, and we have only have about 30 seconds for this, that you've actually always disputed the notion of mowing the grass.
The thing about mowing the grass is that it keeps growing back. And you cannot have any kind of future if you are going to have millions of people under your occupation or surrounding you that want to destroy you. Now, if there was nothing you could do about it, say like with Syria, okay, there's nothing you can do about it. But there is a lot that they can do with their citizens and with the Palestinians, at least on the West Bank. And they simply have not done enough. And that is the problem. To assume that we'll put people down and knock down houses and kill some more people every 7 years or 8 years, that's just not a strategy. That's, I don't know what you call it, but a strategy it's not.
Dov, Michael, Byron, thanks so very much for joining us as always. Really appreciate it. Look forward to having you guys back on next week, which is going to be the big budget week. In the meantime, I hope you guys all have a terrific weekend and a great week, and we'll see you again on Friday.
Thanks, Vago.
Thank you, Vago.
Thanks, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.